This is Birth to Work Radio.
Try to convince a community that had always felt if you had a strong back, you could always make a decent living. That disappeared, but the same people stayed in the community.
The competition is much more prepared in terms of the knowledge base and the expectations, and we have to get there very, very quickly.
The problem with education in America is a problem of trying to use a bureaucratic form to do what is basically a cultural and moral mission.
It's important for business leaders to recognize they play an important role in the vibrancy of the community.
I always felt that as a pediatrician, I was also an educator because the trust that people have in us.
We know that when parents know their children are in an academic crisis, they will move mountains.
The most important thing for parents to do is spend time in human interaction with children.
My goal as a community leader now is to create responsible, engaged citizens. I have to emulate what I want them to do.
And now, here's your hosts, Elaine V. Scott and Rick Stevens.
Hello and welcome to Birth to Work Radio. This is Elaine Scott and Rick Stevens. I am especially delighted to be able to introduce someone who represents an organization that gave me a perspective on life, on children, on parenting, on mothering, and on learning that has been the source of my interest and my passion for developing capable people for the last 30 years of my life. And I am pleased to welcome Janet Doman from the Institutes for the Achievement of Human Potential.
Well, thank you very much. What a kind introduction.
Janet, I was so excited to have you here on this particular series that we're doing. Our listeners are from all levels of professionalism, from all different economic sectors, in ages anywhere from 16 all the way up to the 60s. But what's interesting is they're people who are of a different sort, people who take upon themselves the responsibility and the opportunity to see the world differently and see possibility differently. But all of them that communicate with us regularly talk a lot about a period of time that they want to know more about. And that's the period of life that is being called early learning. And one of the great things that has happened as I have spent time working on the workforce issue of the future was to have the privilege of working with Rick Stevens, because Rick was initially not clear that there was anything more to it than what the traditional education environment and the traditional media talked about. And it was at my insistence that he come and spend some time at the Institutes that he was truly transformed in a matter of a day or so, the way I was in a period of a week, by the work that you do with young children, the what you do with parents to teach their young children. And I think that's the key factor. So I want to ask you to talk a little bit about that and give our listeners a little taste of the history and what it is that you do.
Well, you've touched on the heart of the matter, and the heart of the matter really is not just that the magic is in the child. Tiny children learn more in the first 6 years of life, arguably, than they'll learn in the whole rest of their lifetime. It doesn't mean they won't gain experience, but between birth and six, the brain is growing faster than at any other time. So this is the time when learning is effortless, it's joyous, it's exciting in every way. And if you couple the best student in the world, which is certainly that tiny child, you really would want him to have the very best teacher as well. And as it turns out, he does have the best teacher, because every mother is the best teacher for her child that child will ever have, ever in his lifetime. You know, we know a lot about teaching little kids, and we love little kids, but I would not be as good a teacher for any little child as his own mother will be when she knows how the brain grows, why it grows the way it does, and how to give that child really an enriched environment and all the opportunity that he needs to use his abilities. And that's a very exciting thing. You know, we teach mothers about diapers, and frankly, there's really not much to learn about diapers. And, you know, we've kind of re-educated mothers about nursing babies, and that's a very good thing. It's much better to nurse them. But we act as if the first year of life is a kind of benign illness that the baby will grow out of. You know, we put him in a wheelchair. We bundle him up if he's sick, which he's not. we don't really see it as the incredible time that it is. And once mothers understand that this is not a time to bundle up the baby and hope he'll take long naps and pat him on the head and chuck him on the cheek as if he doesn't understand, this is the time to really look at his environment and say, how can we set up his environment so that it is neurologically correct for him? Instead of put him in a backpack, put him in a car seat, put him in a playpen. You know, the last survey I saw recently said that the average American baby may spend as little as 3 minutes a day actually free on his belly with the liberty to move. The rest of the day, the whole day, is spent with him bundled up, and that's really astonishing. That's not the way our grandmothers were raised. That's not the way babies have been raised. That's a new experiment, and it's not working out very well. Babies are desperate to move. From the moment they are freed from the womb at birth, movement is critical. Let's just take two simple things that mothers can do in the first 12 months of life. The first is to give that baby the maximum time, unbundled up, unfettered by clothing and, you know, snowsuits and all the things we bundle babies in, free on his belly, on the floor to move. We see our babies all day long, carried and bundled and really prevented from moving, so much so that the baby comes to think he can't move. So one big thing that parents can do is recognize that every baby has a mobility imperative and he needs the maximum amount of time on a smooth, clean, warm floor where he can actually move. And you know, there are many cultures that understand this much better than our culture. You know, the Inuit tribes in Alaska, and we actually went and visited them and saw them do this, at birth, when the baby is born, it is the custom to put the baby on mother's naked body and have the baby crawl his way up the body to find the breast and nurse. This is the custom. And Inuit babies at birth do just that. They crawl right up mother's body. Now imagine that. We have a newborn who's actually crawling. But in our society, because we take that newborn, we don't give him a chance to crawl up mother's body. Instead, we bundle him in not one, not two, not three, not four, five little blankets. So he's wrapped up like a mummy. Then we put him on his back in what we call a nursery in the hospital, where he's staring at lights that are on 24 hours a day, and we conveniently locate him as far from mother as possible, where he screams and screams. The opposite of that, of course, would be to not bundle up that baby. The baby must think we're crazy. You know, he's more free in utero. In utero, he can roll, he can kick, he can somersault. Once he's born, he should be moving even more. Heat the room if you have to. Put the temperature up for the baby to keep him warm instead of putting him in layers and layers of clothing that prevent him from moving. Get down on the floor with the baby. One of the wild proposals that we've made years ago now is instead of us having the baby be an inconvenience, we should decide when we bring a baby into the world to arrange his day around what's good for him. To say, gee, the first 3 months, they're critical. Let's see what the baby needs, and instead of packing him up and carrying him around, let's stay home with him and give him the environment he really needs. Now, what are the consequences of that movement? What happens when we give him a chance to actually be on his belly and move? Well, the first and most obvious one is he learns that he can use his arms and legs to move forward. As he does that, as he makes the thousand little experiments he needs to make to move forward, he starts to use his vision. Because as we move through space, we're kind of forced to use our vision. If we don't, we bump into things. And Mother Nature is a kind of tough teacher. As the baby moves on his belly, he does bump into things. And then he says, gee, how did that chair leg hit me in the head? Well, of course it didn't. The baby crawled into it. He then turns on his vision a little more. He uses two eyes together. He starts to develop simple, crude depth perception. If he does not get to move through space, he will not develop that depth perception until much later. And there will be a price to pay for that later on. So we know it's going to help his vision. Well, if you look at mobility and vision, these are two critical areas for the baby. Because when he's born, he's functionally blind. The quicker he is able to see, the sooner he can see the environment around him, the more he will interact with that environment. So the consequences of early movement and of being able to see better are enormous for the baby. We believe movement is the birthright of the baby. Like fresh air and sunshine and good food, movement is the birthright of every baby.
Outstanding. Absolutely outstanding. We're going to take a break and then we'll come right back. Wow, Janet, that was such an incredible description of the significance and the value of movement for newborns in their first years of life. And we've done a couple of interviews with people from Jill Bolte Taylor, who talked about the significance of the brain and the fact that it's a ball of energy needing real movement and experience to help it grow. We've also talked with Judy Jennings, who representing the American Physical Therapy Association, who talked about exactly that same issue. In fact, she said that the problem with kids not moving early on is so severe that the American Physical Therapy Society calls it the container syndrome. This is kids being physically, as you would say, bound down and not allowed to move. But it also poses something else that we have learned over, recognized especially, have been to a number of conferences where they talk about sort of what I'm going to call new information about brain growth and development. And that is that the brain does not lead the way. In fact, it was a pediatrician who was talking to me as I was explaining to him what I learned, you know, in my professional mother's course at the Institutes in 78, that movement is what causes the brain to adapt and grow and adjust to the environment. And he looked at me in great sincerity, and he said, that is not what I learned in medical school. He said, what I learned is that the brain just grows, and it kind of leads the way, and then the body follows. And he said it was basically the opposite. I had never heard that.
Well, I think that the old-fashioned idea from the early part of the last century was the notion that there was a kind of preset alarm clock, and that the alarm clock would go off at 12 months and you would walk. And it really wasn't a product of what came before. You just pulled the calendar, you know, a month off every month, and when you've pulled off 12, the baby more or less then is going to stand up on his 2 feet and he's going to walk. And this notion of that preset alarm clock has been passed down and passed down and passed down. But it turns out that that theory, that model, simply isn't true. Let's take vision as a very clear example. When the baby is born, he really is functionally blind. If we give him the opportunity to move, we put him on his belly, he will have more opportunity to use his vision and more need to use it. Where there's a need, there's always a facility. Mother Nature is a tough teacher. And if we add to that, if we say, Mom, give this baby the opportunity to see light. You know, the light reflex is very important. And in the newborn, he will get some stimulation to that light reflex every time mother turns the lights on and off. If he goes from the dark to the light, that light reflex is stimulated. Well, that happens a few times a day by accident. But if we say to Mom, don't wait for it to happen by accident. Give him, instead of one time a day by accident or two times, why don't we get a flashlight and why don't we stimulate that light reflex 10 times? 1 minute 10 times takes 10 minutes in the whole day. We know that baby is going to start to actually be able to see outline consistently and then see detail much sooner. The average baby will see detail, that is to say, see mother's face smiling at him, when he's about 2.5 or 3 months old. But if we stimulate the light reflex, if we give the baby time on his belly on the floor, the baby will start to see detail much sooner, maybe 6-7 weeks of age. That's half the time. That means that baby will be seeing Mom's face when he's 6 weeks old, not when he's 12 weeks old. That means the next 6 weeks, that he would still have been functionally blind, he can be looking at the whole world around him. That means the stimulation to the brain quadruples. Because at the time when the brain is growing so dynamically, he actually has the function to see, instead of being trapped in a world where he can't see much. So we have five pathways in the brain. We can see, hear, feel, taste, and smell. And those five pathways are the five pathways which we learn about everything. The greatest genius learned through those five pathways. The greatest villain learned through those five pathways. Everything you learned, everything I've ever learned, we learn through those five pathways. Those are ingoing pathways. Then we have three outgoing pathways: mobility, language, and manual competence. And those are the pathways out of the brain. So the more we stimulate the five pathways in, and we give ample opportunity to use the motor pathways, then the baby has the ideal environment. And we discover that that preset alarm clock is just nonsense, because I can make my baby's alarm clock to see detail go off at 6 weeks or 5 weeks, when if I leave him to by accident, it's going to be 12 weeks. So if there is an alarm clock, we've learned how to make it go off when we want it to go off much earlier and give the baby huge opportunity for brain growth. You know, I'll give you a concrete example. A father was in not long ago, and he has four children, and he's raised all his children by giving them a great environment. And, of course, this is his fourth baby, so he's getting pretty good at it. And he said, finally, I achieved my goal. He said, we went into the pediatrician for the three-month checkup. He said, this is my fourth kid. She never looks up from her clipboard. She has her clipboard. She has her questions. She never looks up. And he said, we started describing what the baby was doing. And she said, and movement? And he said, well, we measure his movement every day, and he's now done, he has crawled 5 football fields.
Gee, hey, that's a lot of
she said, geez. He said, finally, she looked up from that clipboard, and she said, he has what? He said, well, he's done 5 football fields now. She said, this baby is 3 months old, but on my checklist, he looks like a 9 month old. What are you doing with this baby?
Yep. Well, see, I think one of the challenges that people have, particularly in the urban environment, as opposed to where we were as an agrarian society where movement was natural. I mean, you grew up on the farm and you're just part of everyday life. So today, those environments just don't exist in the urban environment. And that's one of the key struggles. And so it's, you know, baby in the condo or baby in the house or, you know, plus all the protection items that we put around them. It's no wonder we see the challenges that, that go on. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why we're so excited about this conversation today, is to be able to help, you know, our listeners really understand that early childhood development is so critical and movement is foundational to this. You know, when you think about it, and I don't know if we had this discussion at the end of the last segment on movement, but Jan, as you think about this, I mean, you've clearly observed this for many, many years, in fact, decades. You know, how do you know this stuff really works?
Well, of course, we know it really works for the exact same reason that the Wright brothers knew beyond the shadow of a doubt that you could fly. They did it. They did
it.
And you know,
for
years my father said, one of these days I'm going to put a sign up in the auditorium that says, we know it is so because we do it. We know it is so. On his 80th birthday, well, the day before his 80th birthday, I had a very famous carver climb up into the oak paneling of our auditorium and put a Latin inscription there, and it says in Latin, we know it's so because we do it. So
well,
the sign is there.
Yeah. There you go.
And which I think is a terrific sign, and at least in my family, with the four children I have, one of the challenges they have with me is, while they may be able to get pregnant on their own, before they deliver or shortly after deliver, they have to go to the institute for the very reasons we talk about, so they can learn
well, you know,
what they have to do.
Sometimes parents do send their kids, and maybe they are handcuffed volunteers for the first day, but it's not long before those handcuffs come off, and they say, oh my goodness, I never dreamed that this was possible. And, you know, to say the truth, when the first baby really does arrive, I think an awful lot of new parents, they see that baby, they look into that baby's eyes, and they say, oh, my goodness, no one ever told me that you were going to arrive intelligent. Nobody ever told me that. I thought you were going to be a baby.
You
and
got it.
And now I look at you, and I realize that you are a full-blown human being. You're all there. And you know what? They're absolutely correct. But the problem is they need to know how they can help the baby. What does the baby really need? What does the baby really want? And when we can teach them that, then the closeness of mother and baby and father and baby is gigantic. The affinity is gigantic. The respect is gigantic. And, you know, of all these things, we did what we do because we wanted to grow the brain. And that was our chief interest. But if you ask me 54 years later, is that the most important thing we do? You know what? As great as it is, as important as it is, it's not the most important. The most important is that we are putting mothers and babies back together where they belong, in each other's arms, adoring each other. You know, many, many years ago, a person who really didn't think much of my father's work said, well, all Glenn Doman is doing is pushing mothers and babies closer together. And when my father read that, he said, you know, that's not all we're doing, but put that on my epitaph. Put that on my epitaph.
Oh, Janet, you're terrific. This is just such a delight. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about this world of significance and why getting these pathways laid down early has such a powerful significance long term. We have our data, we have our numbers, and we want to talk a little bit about that. And I also, Janet, I want your list of the 25 most important things every mother should own.
It's probably easier to give you a list of things they don't need.
Like I said, we'll be right back.
This System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce by Rick Stevens and Elaine Scott, is winning accolades as an accessible business novel with a striking new perspective about community collaboration and workforce development for the 21st century. In the book, community leaders in the fictional town of Chantilly learn why they must think and act differently to build a sustainable workforce for the future. Real stakeholder leaders from around the country have used the book as a model for their own communities. Vicki Hogan is president and CEO of the Vermilion Advantage in Danville, Illinois. She and the Vermilion team have been collaborating with Birth to Work to implement the strategies outlined in the system.
Your book is really incredible. It's like a roadmap that in story form really sheds the light on a national issue and makes it obvious in a story form who the key stakeholders really have to be to create sustainability.
Sustainable results will only come from collaboration, alignment, and integration of the people, programs, and ideas of a unified community. The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, shines a light on the challenges that communities across the country are facing right now and the forces that drive and influence people's behaviors. Stakeholder leaders such as Angela Phillips-Diaz are using the book as a guide for effective stakeholder action. In her work with the University of California, Riverside, she's charged with improving the college-going rate in the region.
I literally have the book on my desk and use it as a reference tool all the time. It's been invaluable to me.
This System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, is the guide for stakeholder leaders who want to do business as usual in a new way. Buy it today at birthtowork.org or amazon.com.
This is Elaine Scott, Rick Stevens, and we have the pleasure of speaking with Janet Doman today, the director and the lead lecturer and all-in-one sort of director of the Institutes for the Achievement of Human Potential, an organization that has been studying, working with parents, and developing important and valuable training for parents to work with their children. And I took the second ever class that they did for well babies, and what I learned from that class has stayed with me my whole life as a result of the benefits of being able to apply fundamental knowledge such as you gave us in the first part of our program about what babies really are capable of doing and how you go about doing that or some things you can do to stimulate and facilitate that. Why? Why is that significant, and what are some long-term implications And I'm going to give you just a couple of points on my part that when I talk to people, I draw this information out, and you can certainly correct me if I've overstated this, the benefits. But I talk about a phenomenon that I actually observed when I was working with a summer science camp, and that's actually the place where I actually met Rick and we started working together years ago, where I saw little kids, 5, 6 years old, who had trouble with their hands. They couldn't hold things very well. They could hardly manipulate scissors. They couldn't do what I was thinking were fairly ordinary things for kids to do. And as I explored more, I began to gather data on some of the developmental difficulties that kids were having showing up at 5 and 6 years old in school. And holding their hands in a fisted position was very common, but being able to actually manipulate, maneuver their fingers was actually much more, not being able to do that was much more common than people wanted to admit. There was also a rise in the number of kids wearing glasses. Kids who are having speech problems, kids who have asthma, lung issues. And I had learned that all of those things were things that were, in many cases, related to the kinds of early development that were aided and abetted by creeping and crawling, like developing your chest muscles and developing your shoulders and developing your neck and developing your head and then your eyes. And actually, when you're leaning forward, the tongue, the gravity pulls it down so that you actually, this spitting and slobbering that babies do helps you develop a speech capacity and capability. And when I tell people that in a very simple and very straightforward way, they go, you know, all that makes perfect sense. I just never thought about it. And I want to really validate that that's what I learned, and it never once occurred to me that people wouldn't do that or didn't see it. And so I ask you, is that, have I overstated the value of the belly time and the creeping and crawling and movement?
I don't think you could overstate it, because when you look at the good consequences of movement on the belly and then pushing up on hands and knees to creep, one of the things, perhaps the most important thing we haven't really talked about, and that is how that develops respiration. All mothers know when the baby's born that babies don't breathe very well. And that's why all mothers are naturally very spastic about the baby and breathing. You know, mothers go and check on the baby several times a night, and what they're checking on is to see, is the baby breathing? And if mother can't see the baby breathing, she will shake the baby a little bit, wake him up, and then he cries, and she says, oh, he's fine. And dad says, why'd you wake up the baby? Well, mother says, no, don't worry, he's fine. Mother didn't really want to wake him up. She wanted to make sure he was breathing. Because all mothers know babies don't breathe very well. Now, once that baby starts to crawl, the first thing you'll notice is his breathing is starting to mature. The more he crawls, crawling's hard work. The more he crawls, the better that breathing gets. It gets deeper. It gets more regular. It gets more mature. When he pushes up to creep, and creeping's a whole lot easier in that regard than crawling, well, you can move faster. And as he moves faster, of course, again, his breathing is maturing. So then when he gets up on 2 feet and begins to walk and then to run, again, it's another level of developing his respiration. Well, what are the good consequences of that? First of all, our babies don't get sick as much as other babies do. Secondly, our babies can make sounds, because the ability to make meaningful sounds is very important to the baby. He has to be able to communicate. And to do that, he has to make not just sounds, but meaningful sounds. Well, to make meaningful sounds, you have to be able to control your breathing, your inhalation, and your exhalation. And of course, he's going to want to turn those meaningful sounds into actual specific sounds that mother will understand as words. Our babies are in communication with their mothers months before other babies, because they start using meaningful sounds in the first few weeks of life. And mother says, oh, he's trying to talk to me. Then she listens to him more, and then the more she listens to him, the more he talks to her. And the more he talks to her, the more she talks back. So instead of waiting till the baby is 13 or 14 months old and can make a sound that everybody knows is a word, she learns in the first few weeks of life, my baby is trying to talk to me. And a great part of that result is respiratory maturity, which comes about only through mobility. So right. If you really ask me what I think is the single greatest effect of having a chance to move, I would say for the safety of the baby, the health of the baby, the neurological development of the baby, it's that respiratory maturation, which is so important to the baby. And once the baby is talking to mom, using those meaningful sounds, using specific sounds, then the cycle of communication is complete, and the baby is much happier. He doesn't have to use the birth cry to communicate everything. I mean, you don't have to go far. Go into any supermarket, any mall, and you'll see 5-month-old babies, 6-month-old babies, 12-month-old babies using the birth cry to communicate. When the baby wants anything, what does he do? Wah! Wah! Well, that's fine for a tiny newborn baby. But when you're 3 months old, that's a pretty harsh communication. It's very stressful to mother, and it gets to be very rude. Our babies don't communicate that way. Why would they do that when they can use meaningful sound? When they can go, and mother says, oh, he's not happy. Are you not happy? Something wrong? And then she'll put up two hands. Is something wrong? Yes or no? She holds up the right hand and says yes. She holds up the left hand and says no. The baby looks at the right hand. She says, oh, okay, so something's wrong. Let's find out what it is. Do you need a diaper change? Are you wet? Yes or no? He looks at yes. Well, okay, let's change that diaper. Now that is all achieved with no screaming, no crying, just the baby giving her some meaningful sound that sounds like he's irritable and not happy. And then immediately she goes to, let's find out what's going on. And once she plays that game with the baby, he can trust her, she can trust him. Do you see how simple that is? That level of communication will not take place for most children until they're 14 or 15 months old. My goodness, can you imagine living through 15 months of frustration as a tiny baby? Why? When you can be communicating with a baby in the first few weeks of life.
I think what you've done is really put on the table the value, the incredible value and the sense of possibility. I feel like I own this little treasure now that I have this all captured here. But I want to go out into the public arena. I want to go out into the ballparks, and I'm going to give you some feedback that came to me by one of the people that was a longtime friend who was also a coach when she was in high school. And she had her own children later in life, and she was taking them to the ballparks to play. She was absolutely shocked at the number of kids that couldn't run. She said, I cannot even imagine such a thing, but she said these kids could not run. They could not run in this cross pattern. And she was shocked at that. And she said, Elaine, that says to me they're missing the early development that we, frankly, what you're talking about, we simply took for granted. We assumed that the development that was needed to make little kids T-ball or baseball or little league players or soccer players was going on. And what happened was that when it got down to the level of being a joke, I was listening to a comedy series by Bill Engvall, and he was laughingly, as you know, things are often, the serious things are most often spoken about in jest. He was saying, what's wrong with these kids that show up to play T-ball? He said, whatever happened to having to arch your back, hold the bat, move your legs? He said, where did that go? He said, what's with these kids? You know, they have to have the ball placed in front of them. They can hardly swing at it and hit it. But this isn't just true in some places around the country. It's true all across the country. And when I listen to people and I hear them talk about it, it's important to notice that people notice those things that are wrong down the line. They just don't know where it went wrong. And what you're talking about is where it went wrong and how to do something about it. And you forgot to give me your list of the 25 things you want people to own. So we're going to come back. We're going out. And we're going to come right back. And we're going to talk about some real critical steps for parents to go take and how to influence exactly what we're talking about right now. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We were just in the middle of a whole complete thought about moving outside of the world of kids from being inside the house to being outside, and lots of people knowing that there's something wrong, something's not well with so many, many kids all across the country. When I'm flying and I'm going back and forth, and you have to understand, it's my interview seat, me and somebody, and they're talking to me about their kids, and they're going, well, I don't know what you're saying, but I can tell you, I just noticed that the kids don't play basketball very well. And there was a coach here in Chicago who was flying with me on a flight back to Chicago, and he said, I see these kids coming in year after year after year. I've been doing this about 12 years. He said, every year they're getting worse. He said, they just don't move. They don't know how to use their bodies. They can't run. And then you hear young fathers talking about their kids playing Little League, and they you know, as I said earlier, they can't do that either, and they're having a hard time hitting a t-ball, much less playing soccer games and running. And then you have your, I'm not going to tell you every child is like that, of course they're not, but unfortunately the numbers are so large right now that mm-hmm. that it's a source of, almost like a source of mystery, and people don't really feel like they understand what's happened, that kids are spending so much time indoors as opposed to outdoors.
Yeah, and of course we've allowed a whole generation or two generations to grow up in front of a TV or in front of a game console, or, I mean, hours and hours and hours a day spent sedentary and immobile. You know, when a baby is given a chance to move, which is what he wants to do, right from day one, by the time he's 3.5 or 4, he's not only running, but our 4-year-olds run a mile. By the time they're 5, they do a little biathlon every year. By the time they're 6, we do a little triathlon. They jump in a pool. They swim 1/4 mile. They get out of the pool, jump on a bike. They do 10K on the bike, jump off the bike, and they run 5K. You know, a 6-year-old, 7-year-old, 8-year-old. We do it every year. Our whole school does it. It's not like the athletes do it. All of our kids are athletes. All of them. Every single one. By the time they graduate from our little school at 13, they will do that triathlon in less than 60 minutes. Try that sometime. 1/4 mile swim, 10K bike, 5K run, less than 60 minutes.
Oh,
I mean, that's okay, an athlete. And they don't do, by the way, and you know what they do when they finish the triathlon? Any kid who hasn't finished yet, they go around the track with him. The only person who they're concerned about their time is themselves. They just want to do a slightly better time than they did the year before. There is no competition. We don't think competition is a good idea at all. So being an athlete, it's natural to a child. I wonder, how did we create 2 or 3 generations of kids who can't hit a ball or can't run across the field? Well, we did that by arranging right from birth for the baby not to move. I assure you, if you give a tiny baby a chance to move, and you give that 15-month-old a chance to run, and you give that 18-month-old a chance to jump and climb, you won't be able to stop him. At 4, he's going to be running a mile. That's where it all begins. The brain grows by use, just like the biceps. And it grows dramatically between conception and 6. So this is the critical time to give opportunity, because then it's so easy, it's so effortless. Tiny children have a rage to move. They would rather move and learn than do anything else in the world. If we honor that in the first 6 years of life, when it is natural to the child and native to him, imagine what he's like at 12. You know, if you can go to a library at age 6 and get out any book you want. One of our kids was reading Shogun at age 6. It was his favorite book. He drove us crazy. He went through 6 copies of that book. We had to keep buying him another one because he carried it around like a teddy bear, and the book fell apart. Another kid was reading The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich at 6. Do we really have to ask, is he going to be a good student when he goes to school? He had been studying those issues since he was... He said to me at 4, one day I'm going to read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And he said, I'm not ready yet. I'm working up to it. But when he was 6, he was ready. We have looked at little children as if they're little nincompoops. We have to look and see who's really there. They can learn absolutely anything that we can present to them in an honest, factual, and joyous way. And we shouldn't let it happen by accident. It doesn't happen by accident. In the modern world, it won't happen by accident.
That's correct.
We have to arrange the environment to honor intellectual growth, to honor physical growth, to honor social growth. Every child has a right to it.
I think that what I can attest to is I saw that when I was there. I met those kids. I met those parents. And I had the privilege of being associated with a whole group of parents who had gone to the institutes. And together we had a program. We had a community that we shared across miles over Southern California. And out of that, what we did was we had a common belief system. We had a common understanding and we had common language, which is a large part what we talk about when we talk about building capable people and excellent relationships that build capable people in communities. And that group of parents was a perfect example of motivation, expectation, and language, which is what brings people together and allows them to thrive. We have such a mismatch in this culture. And my concern is that many people have taken and or adopted pieces of the Institute's program, and the things that you do are like the violin or the music. We've had people try to teach kids just music. Well, in and of and by itself, music is wonderful.
Sure.
But when it's done with a comprehensive understanding of the use of music as a part of a whole integrated program, the difference in results is huge, and the emotional well-being of the child is huge. And I'm going to ask Stephanie if she's still there with us. Stephanie, are you still there?
Yeah.
Stephanie was my motivation in the first place for taking the class, and I wanted you to comment, just as an adult now, looking back over your, you obviously couldn't remember your experience when you were there at 7 months, but you knew very well. You knew very well that there was something different about yours and your sister's growing up. And could you give Janet just a kind of a sense of that in our audience about what it was, about how you saw the world that you felt was noticeably different?
Sure. I think early on I was very clear that there was not a whole lot in the whole world that I couldn't do. And it came from no sense of arrogance, I don't think. I didn't think, I had no opinions that I was better than other people. But when it came to being able to tackle any challenge, whether that challenge, at like 4 and a half was learning how to, buckle my shoes or what have you, or much later, whether it was learning honors algebra in seventh grade, and all the way up through high school and college, even to this day, I still know that I have a pretty keen sense that with a base understanding, I can do just about anything. And that was always a tremendous gift. I've never understood, obviously, as I've gotten older and more mature, I've learned the social dynamics around things, but I never understood at a very base level why folks don't have any sense of confidence in their ability to physically or mentally or emotionally understand something.
It's wonderful to hear you say that, because I think for us, after some 45 years of doing this with our kids, I think that people say, well, what are they all like? And I think there's this sense that, our kids would all be like coming out of a cookie cutter or something. And, of course, the more capable a human being is, the less he is like his fellow kid. Everybody is unique. And the more ability that you have, the more you show that unique part of you. So our kids are all different. They're not all the same. They're nothing like cookie cutter kids. They're all absolutely different, but they have in common, I think, two characteristics very strongly. One is they are very confident, but it's a quiet confidence, not a noisy confidence, and they are all very gentle. And those are two wonderful characteristics. Those were the things, if you lined up all our kids, I think they're the two outstanding characteristics. And I can even hear that in your voice. I was talking to one of our kids who started as a baby, and she's now probably 34, 35 years old. She breezed through school. She went to the London School. She's born in Mexico, raised there, but she went to the London School of Economics for graduate school. Now she's a mother with two kids. But when she was being asked the same question by an interviewer who was a little aggressive with her about it and what makes you so different, and she said, no, I'm not different. I was given a great opportunity and a lot of stimulation when I was a little girl. And I found, I was very lucky, I went to very good schools. And, of course, in those schools, the other students in the schools were very good students, too. She said, my mother didn't teach me everything. I had to learn new subjects and things I'd never learned before. But the difference between me and the other kids was that I didn't have to stay up all night. I didn't have to worry. I didn't have to get stressed out. I knew I could do it. And I could do it with a lot less effort and a lot less stress. I really enjoyed it. And often they didn't. And in the end, I could achieve my goals.
Stephanie, would you say that was true of you and Summer?
And Summer, absolutely. I would agree with that 100%. And furthermore, because I enjoyed it, I retained it. And
yes.
And I keep wanting to do it again and again through life.
Janet Doman, you are a delight, a pleasure, a gift, and I look forward to another follow-up conversation with you very shortly. To all of our listeners, Janet can be reached at the Institutes for the Achievement of Human Potential on www.iahp.org. Come to our website. We have lots of information on her work and the work of the Institutes, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
Thank you for joining us on Birth to Work Radio. For more information about Birth to Work, to stream or download podcasts of archived radio programs, or to purchase a hard copy or downloadable version of Rick and Elaine's book, The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, please visit our website at birthtowork.org. That's birth, the number two, work.org. We invite you to send us your feedback and questions directly by emailing info@birthtowork.org. Birth to Work Radio, the voice of community stakeholder leaders.